A new epidemic sweeps through war-torn Europe, leaving strange symptoms in its wake.
A woman bursts into the pub and declares, help me, I've just escaped from being murdered.
I'm Fraser Coffeen.
And I'm Jennifer Coffeen.
And this is Creepy History. Hello, everybody. Hello.
Yay. This is our second post-Halloween episode.
Yeah.
We're in November now.
It is November. Yes. Halloween has happened. We are in. It is definitely fall time.
Yeah. It's like deep fall. Almost winter.
Yeah. There's fall. Fall is fleeting.
Yeah. Which is kind of a scarier time in some ways.
The fleeting fall?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because everything starts to look dead.
Oh, sure. That's fair. Yeah. I think the scariest time is the post-holiday time in winter when you get the black sludge. That's when it's really scary.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
It's just kind of gross.
Nobody likes that.
It's sad. Yep.
So that's where we're heading towards. Yes. I think, you know, it's funny. I hadn't really planned it that way. But now that you mention it, I think my story kind of fits in with that sort of, you know, end of fall, getting kind of dead stuff vibe.
Yeah. Mine's kind of, disturbing.
Excellent. Disturbing is good. We like disturbing.
Yep.
I will accept that. Hey, before we dive in, we have an exciting little piece of news for you all, our faithful listeners. You should check out the Chicago Writers Podcast, which
right.
We just recently were guests on.
That's right. I think it came out October 30th.
I believe
31st.
So. Somewhere
yeah,
there.
We were guests on there with Dan Finnan, and we were just chatting about spooky stories and what makes a spooky story and all that kind of stuff. It was really fun.
Yeah, very fun to do.
Yeah.
So go check that out, and a shout out to Dan Finnan and an excellent podcast. We were very pleased to be and honored to be guests there.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Super fun. Do you want to check out our exciting fall cocktail?
Yes, it's very fally. It is actually warm.
It is a warm drink.
If you go and check out our Instagram, it's on there when we recorded. It's a little bit a few weeks back, but it's in a mug instead of our normal cocktail glass, and it's very warm. I'm very excited about it.
I'm excited to check it out.
Smell it. I would like to guess what it is, but I don't want to ruin it.
Go ahead.
Should I guess?
Yeah.
Is it hot buttered rum?
It is.
Yay!
Look at you with your cocktail knowledge. Hot buttered rum, a name I've always seen and a cocktail I've never had.
Same. And I mean it's warm, and I did, when you smell it, you can smell sort of the rum, and it smells buttery.
Yeah.
So is there actually butter in it?
Yeah, yes, there is. I'll tell you more about it in a minute.
Right,
let's have a sip. I'm curious to find out. I could see this being really good, or I could see it being lame.
It smells lovely.
It's
but
a
here's
great
the thing.
Smell.
Mulled wine also smells lovely, and mulled wine makes me want to die.
No, but that's where you're wrong. Mulled
really,
wine smells
really horrible.
Nope. Glug smells and is lovely. Ooh,
yeah.
I gotta make some glug before this season's out.
Are you saying glug? Like
glug. Right? What am I supposed to say?
I mean, I guess.
What is it?
I say glog, which I'm sure
is geez.
Not correct.
No. Certainly not that.
I like how you're giving it a Scandinavian twist.
It is. It's a Scandinavian drink.
I know. It's just funny.
All right.
Cheers. Oh, man.
Not what you were hoping for?
It doesn't taste at all what it smells like. It's mulled wine all over again.
Mulled wine too.
It's so painful.
No.
It has this smell, and you think it's going to smell... I mean, you think it's going to taste like caramely or something.
You know what it tastes like?
Rum.
Warm rum.
Yeah, it just tastes like rum.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot else going on than warm rum.
And like, but it smells so lovely. Like, you think it's going to have this, like, kind of, like a caramel kind of taste.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't at all.
There's a lot going on in here to make the
I know.
Warm rum.
What's in it?
Brown sugar, butter, vanilla, cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice, rum, and water.
I don't taste any of it. Oh, the second sip is better.
Maybe it's not stirred enough? Did I not stir it properly?
I don't know. You should go get a spoon.
I'm going to get a spoon. entertain the people.
No, you have to pause it. Oh, you're just going over there. All right, we are...
All right, I'm back with a spoon.
We're going to make an attempt here. You guys are here listening to it as it's happening.
There's stirring sound. There's
you
also,
have like a cinnamon stick in there.
You do too. There's a cinnamon stick hiding
in
there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it definitely feels like there should be more flavor going on. All right, we're going to try again,
well,
you guys.
The recipe was confusing because it's like a dash and a splash and stuff like that. So how much of that do you put in?
Yeah, it's a little better.
All right, that helped.
I have to say, it's growing on me now. I think the first sip I had was just, like, full rum.
Yeah.
And then you're like, bangs. And now it's a little bit better.
That helped. Right.
I'm going to keep sipping at it.
Okay.
And I'll let you know.
All right.
Probably every sip, it'll get a little bit better.
Sure. A little quick history on the hot buttered rum, just
yeah.
real fast.
Yeah.
So I don't have a ton to it, but it is a pretty old drink. It's a... offshoot of a big drink in the 1600s, which is, of course, the hot toddy.
Sure.
Right? And that was a very big drink.
Oh, hot toddy is that old?
Yeah, yeah. Hot toddy's been around for a long time. And then in, like 1650-ish, the hot toddy made its way over to, well, not the United States, but the... you know, this area that would sure. eventually become the United States. And they did not have as much whiskey over here at the time, but they did have a lot of rum. And so they swapped the whiskey and the hot toddy out for rum, and they remade it, and it became the hot buttered rum.
I could see how, you know, when it's like winter or, you know, it's cold out and things like that, like having this would be just delightful.
Yeah, like around a fire or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, and appropriately, if you're feeling that, if it's the right weather on January 17th, you should pour yourself one because January 17th is National Hot Buttered Rum Day.
Yay!
So there we go.
I have to say, it's kind of growing on me a little bit. I do like it.
Nice.
Yeah.
There you go.
I think it's not so rummy.
It's not quite as rummy as you would initially.
I'm still like getting all the flavors that you put in there, though. Okay? I feel like if you put all that stuff in there, you know, it should have more of that. Maybe.
Well, like I said, I think it was. I had a bit of a tough time because the recipe definitely said a dash of cinnamon, a dash of nutmeg, a splash of vanilla. Like, how much is that?
But maybe too. Like, I'm very sensitive to the alcohol taste. Maybe other people are less.
Maybe hot buttered rum, also the name of a band. A kind of, I've never really listened to them.
Really?
Assume they're like a relative, I think they're a current band, and based on where I see them, I assume that they're kind of like a jam band, hippie,
that sounds about
funky
right.
jam band kind of thing. But maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe they're listening to this and they're like a hardcore punk band and they're mortally offended that I said that about them.
Who knows? I mean, if you're a punk band and you name yourself Hot Buttered Rum.
Yeah, you get what you get.
You get what you get.
That's true. They seem like they belong in the same category as like Leftover Salmon, right?
Is that a name of a band?
Sure, Leftover Salmon. They probably opened for Widespread, probably. Widespread Panic, for those of you not from the South and highly acquainted with your 90s jam band scene.
Leftover Salmon.
Sure. Oh, come on. I could rattle these off all day.
Yeah.
Moe. You know, all those bands.
All right.
There we go. Let's move on. We've really digressed.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready
I
for
apologize.
Your story. You're
okay.
first tonight, right?
I am. All right, so here is my tale. My story is, the title, I guess I would call it, is The Sleeping Sickness. The Sleeping Sickness.
Ooh. Do I know this?
I don't know.
I don't know if I know this.
We'll find out, won't we?
All right,
so here we go. So I'm telling you the tale of a medical event. Yes, The Sleeping Sickness. Technical name, Encephalitis Lethargica. Encephalitis lethargica.
Yeah,
so encephalitis is a word for the inflammation of the brain.
Okay.
And lethargica, lethargy, right? So it's, it was an illness where people were falling asleep. It is not, to be clear, the same thing as the tsetse fly stings you with and you fall asleep from the tsetse fly. You don't know the thing about the tsetse fly?
No. What is that? Why
that's
do
a different
I know
sleeping.
Nothing?
That's a different sleeping sickness. That a fly. The only reason I know that is because in the Atari Indiana Jones game, poor Indy would get stung by tsetse flies and he would fall asleep.
So does it like just kind of knock you out for a while?
I didn't study up on this. Is not the tsetse fly, so I did not study up on the
tsetse
fly.
Well, now we got to know. Like, is it like killing you or is it like knocking you out?
You're asking questions about the wrong disease.
Yeah.
I got nothing.
All right.
It's not that, to be clear.
Okay.
This is encephalitis lethargica. So this beginning of the story starts in winter of 1916 in Vienna. And there is a sort of new illness that doctors there in Vienna are seeing around. They're seeing people being very lethargic, and showing a sort of what they describe as a mask-like face. Here is a quote.
Oh, I thought you were going to show me the mask.
No, I'm sorry.
I was going to get very disturbed.
Nope. Okay. This is a quote from a gentleman named Oliver Sacks, and he said, and here's his quote about it. He said,
Oliver Sacks. Sorry.
Very nice. He said, "They would be conscious and aware, yet not fully awake. They would sit motionless and speechless all day in their chairs, totally lacking energy, impetus, initiative, motive, appetite, affect, or desire. They registered what went on about them without active attention and with profound indifference. They neither conveyed nor felt the feeling of life. They were as insubstantial as ghosts and as passive as zombies."
That sounds like me when I was 13. Yeah.
You really set that up for yourself.
Thanks,
very nice.
Thanks.
How far into that quote did you plan that? It was good.
It's like middle part.
Nice, good.
Yeah, thank you.
So there was this, basically these people were just like falling asleep or falling into like a sleep-like coma-ish state.
But they were obviously like kind of sitting up.
Yep.
As opposed to like,
yep.
Because otherwise it would be a coma.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gee. So they must have been somewhat awake, I guess, if sitting up and...
Depends on the person. Yeah, exactly.
That's horrifying.
Right. And it was starting to happen. Again, they were kind of seeing this out of nowhere. Now, it turned out later that there were some earlier reports. Again, this is winter of 1916 in Vienna. There were some earlier reports than that, but like throughout Europe. So this was not just in Vienna. This was happening in other places in Europe. But 1916 is the middle of World War I, and so there's communication channels are not fantastic.
Right.
You know, there's not a lot of medical information being shared because everybody's worried about the war. So in April of 1917, this Austrian who has been studying it, named, great name here, Konstantin Freiherr von Economo.
That's right.
Yeah, Konstantin Freiherr von Economo. He's been studying it, and he puts a paper out. His previous work, just before this, was the gloriously titled, and just sounds like a laugh a minute, On the Development of the Pituitary Gland in Birds. So,
oh man,
so that's what von Economo had been up to.
How much time and energy went into that?
Hey, listen, I respect it. He had a passion,
yep,
for the pituitary gland in birds, and he's
like, this
did it.
This is gonna be my thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He dug in. So he was a pilot in the war originally, but then he became a military doctor. And while he was being a military doctor, he started to see this encephalitis lethargica in some of the soldiers. So he became interested in it, and he started studying it. And von Economo finds, through his studying, he finds three different groups of people who are affected by this. Finds that he classifies them in the following. He has one group that he calls the somnolent.
Mm-hmm.
And those are folks who are showing facial paralysis.
Okay.
Much like Sacks described there. They're very frozen. They're not able to, you know, they're not really moving or anything like that. Sometimes they would lapse into an actual coma.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they would die from respiratory failure. They would just sort of, basically the gist was they would just kind of sit down, stop moving, and then just not move again, and sometimes
and their body
die.
Shut down completely.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. My gosh, that's crazy.
And they were very stumped as to what this was happening. Now, here's the weird thing.
So I was gonna, when you're talking about World War One, I was gonna say, is this trauma based? But I mean, you're not gonna die like that.
Don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then there was another group. Very bizarrely, there was another group who had the same. It was the same disease, but they were showing symptoms being hyperkinetic. So they were very twitchy, and they had insomnia.
Okay.
So it was manifesting in these very different kinds of ways,
mm-hmm,
right? Twitchy, insomnia versus, like, you know, just sitting and eventually slipping into, like, a coma.
Yeah.
And then there was a third that he didn't give a name to. The first two, again, somnolent and hyperkinetic. There was a third he didn't give a real name to, but they were dealing with some long-term effects, many of whom ultimately had Parkinson's as a result of this.
Okay.
So he's the one, Von Economo is the one who finds enough here, enough unique about this, and enough characteristics between all of these cases to actually identify it as its own disease. And he's mm-hmm. the one who kind of gives it the name and first writes this paper that classifies it as its own disease. And because of that, it sometimes is actually called Von Economo's disease. That's not the real name, but it gets called that.
Can I ask you a question? Do people ever come out of it, or is it like once you started, like that was?
They did. Okay, yeah, we'll talk about that a little more.
Okay,
they would. Yeah. So it wasn't guaranteed that you were going to go into
coma. Right. Like, was it something that like it would come and go, or it came and then people like recovered from
it? Yeah, I don't think it would come and go. But yes, people did recover from it.
Okay.
Sometimes you would recover. Sometimes you would not.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, there is also another guy in France who is researching this same thing, Jean-René Cruchet.
Yeah.
He's studying it as well, and he publishes, he's one of those poor, unfortunate scientists who publishes just after the other guy.
Sure.
You know, like, he just spent a little bit too long proofreading that paper, and
now nobody cares.
Bummer for him. It's occasionally called Cruchet's disease, but
not so much.
Not often. So he was studying similarly to Von Economo, who was seeing it initially in the military. Cruchet is studying French soldiers.
Okay.
He sees this. So there is a real military connection.
Yeah.
Great note on who this Jean-René Cruchet is. I didn't know, you know, obviously I'd never heard of him.
Jean-René Cruchet. What a name.
Yep. And so I looked up to find out a little bit more about him, and I found this great quote where it said of him, he is widely remembered for his research of spasmodic torticollis. So there you go. Every time you think about spasmodic torticollis, you've got Jean-René Cruchet
right.
to thank for it.
We should all aspire to that. Mm-hmm. That's so funny. But you know, there are people in that field.
Yeah.
And they're the guy.
I know.
He's the guy.
There you go. So many more cases start to develop, and this starts to become a real epidemic throughout Europe. It goes in Europe from, there were some earlier cases. So first cases in Europe about 1915
mm-hmm.
Up until 1926. So
wow.
A solid 11 years
yeah.
you're seeing all these cases. It also, during that time, crosses over to the U.S. And a little shorter of a run there. It's predominantly in the U.S. from 1920 to 1924. A little bit better records in the U.S. for whatever reason. And in the U.S., there's about, from 1920 to 1924, there's roughly 1 million people diagnosed with this.
Wow.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, 1 million.
And also, that's back when, like, so many people probably weren't getting diagnosed in any way.
Right, right.
Like, they're not going into a doctor. It's not being recorded.
Yeah, they're just
anyway.
Sitting in their house.
So if 1 million of them are actually, yeah. like, written down, recorded, imagine how many people actually
yeah.
had it.
It is a full-on epidemic.
That is.
Yeah. So it's interesting.
Oh, I bet people totally thought it was demon-based.
Demons are, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? It's really creepy. They're just
yeah.
frozen, and they just, like, stop moving, right?
That's really horrifying. I bet it was like so many people getting dragged into churches and exorcisms and
yeah,
you
yeah.
know.
Now, another thing that happens around this time that kind of gets that the encephalitis lethargica, sleeping sickness, gets kind of connected with is in 1918 is when there is the Spanish flu pandemic.
Okay,
we all, you know, heard about the Spanish flu
yeah.
early in the COVID-19 days. There was a lot of talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 1918. That's, you know, shortly before it's in the U.S., but right in the midst of it in Europe.
Yeah.
And there's a connection here. Quick little sidebar that I discovered. I found this really fascinating. Do you know why the Spanish flu is called the Spanish flu?
You know, I do, and I can't remember.
I did not know this. I find
tell
this really
me, yeah,
fascinating.
Tell me again.
The assumption is that it's because it originated in Spain.
Which is not true.
Which is not true. In fact, what the deal is, again, 1918, so we're talking World War I.
Yeah, it came from the trenches, right?
Not exactly. So Spanish flu, it's in the middle of World War I, and because it's World War I, most, newspaper articles and things like that around that time that places are putting out are pretty, like, cognizant of propaganda, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to, you know, present things in a good way. And, you know, a country who's involved in the war does not want to put out an article for everyone in the world to read that's like, oh, our citizens are dying of this flu, right? They want to kind of keep that under wraps.
Right.
Spain... Yeah. remained neutral in World War One, so Spain was just out there reporting the news like rational people. So they actually reported on this. They were not the only one that had it, but they were the only ones reporting on it.
So people thought it was coming.
So people assumed it was coming from Spain. Where it actually came from? Kansas.
Stop.
Yep.
It did?
That's where it started. Spanish flu is actually the Kansas flu. So there you go.
I thought it came from Europe, at least.
That's the prejudice that has been instilled upon us by the name Spanish flu.
So it just, how do they know it started in Kansas?
No, I don't know, but that's where it started.
That's
Kansas.
Amazing.
There you go.
You're like, where did it start? Kansas.
Kansas. So anyway, the Spanish flu.
Well done, Kansas.
Yep. Spanish flu is out
there.
What are
they doing there? I'm sorry.
Who knows?
It's the hot buttered rum. Stop talking.
Spanish flu is out there. The two things are happening, and there's a lot of questions asking if these things go together, right?
Sure.
Is the sleeping sickness a side effect of the Spanish flu?
Mm-hmm.
Did the pandemic of the Spanish flu allow it to spread? Was there a sort of lowered immunity that came from the pandemic that allowed it, again, that allowed it to spread and allowed it to sort of get out there? All theories, all have been talked about, all have looked at. Today, there is a modern theory about the relationship between Spanish flu and this sleeping sickness. And that modern theory that most people subscribe to nowadays is that they are not related in any way. They're just two illnesses that happen at the same time.
It doesn't sound like it would be.
Yeah, just two things. So
I have a theory, but I don't want to throw it out in case you're going to talk about it.
Well, it's interesting. So we'll talk about it.
We'll see if you say it.
So this is, you know, you've got these people. And then here's the fascinating thing. This is, I think, the most interesting piece right here. In 1927, it just stops. They just stop getting any new cases.
Yeah.
They didn't solve it. They don't know the cause. They don't know why it ended. They have no clue. Just all of a sudden, in 1927, it's not like everybody just, like, wakes up one morning.
Right.
But, like,
new cases stop.
They just flat out stop getting new cases. And they do not know why. And they do not. They did
and
not
sorry,
do
you
anything
say,
different.
You said it started in 1916.
15.
15. Okay, so like 10, 11 years later.
Yeah.
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 So no new cases, but different. You asked before, you know, what kind of were the results of it, and they varied very wildly from people. Right. So the results could be very different. There were some people who had a total, complete recovery, totally fine. There were some who had some sort of neurological or psychiatric disorders, some of which didn't materialize until years later. So they recovered and they were fine, and then a few years later they started to show some sort of, Parkinson's being a very common one, but other things as well. Some of them stayed in a state of permanent stasis. Just never came out of
it. That's horrible.
Just continued to sit and stare in a sort of, you know, comatose but not actually coma state for the remainder of their lives.
Okay, this might be the hot buttered rum talking. Isn't there a Robin Williams
movie? Oh, there is! Well done!
Is that what it is?
That is the one! We'll talk about that in just a minute.
All right.
Nicely done.
Yes, yes!
Nicely done. We'll come back to that. And then the last result, you know, again, recovery, permanent stasis, disorders, or death. About 500,000 people died of this.
Oh, my gosh. And then also that coupled with the Spanish flu, coupled with the war.
Yeah, it was a bad time. Bad time. Mm-hmm. So that was difficult. Over the years, there's been a lot of research on this, but it's not super, you know, the research hasn't really been super definitive. People have looked back to try to trace the history of it.
Sure.
And, you know, look at old medical journals, medical articles, things like that, that are sort of, you know, unknown. And there have been, people have discovered earlier events that now can be attributed to this and say, okay, you know, this thing that they didn't know what happened here is probably an earlier epidemic of this. So They've traced it back to as early as 1580. In particular, a couple notable ones. There was a whole London epidemic from 1673 to 1675.
Wow.
Again, it wasn't, right, it wasn't named until this epidemic, and they didn't really think of it as a singular disease. But when you look back at the journals, they're like, it's okay, the same clearly this is
thing,
it.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, epidemic in London from 1673 to 1675, an epidemic in Germany from 1712 to 1713.
Wow. And they're so short.
Yep. And an epidemic in Italy in 1890 that Italy called the Nona.
Oh, that's you've
got,
so scary.
You've got the Nona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he's, I don't like that.
He's staring off. He's gone into the Nona.
It feels very ghosty.
Yeah. So, but then the, you know, one of the sort of notable pieces of it is that gentleman I mentioned at the beginning, Oliver Sacks.
Mm-hmm.
So he studied this disease quite extensively. And in fact, he worked with patients who were dealing with the impact from the epidemic many years later, in like the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
He was working with patients who were still either still in that permanent stasis or suffering some disorders from it. And he wrote a book about it, and that's the book that became Awakenings.
Awakenings, that's what it is.
There it is. So that guy I quoted in the beginning, Oliver Sacks, that's Robin Williams.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, Awakenings, that's the movie. Robin Williams is the doctor, Robert De Niro is the patient.
Yes. Because I have like a very faint memory of like, he like bounced a ball and then like one of the patients who was like, like not moving.
Yes.
Like, you know, and then just like, you see the hand go up.
Yeah, and one of the things that Sacks slash Williams was doing, and this is in the movie, and this is true, is they were working with a drug called L-Dopa.
Mm-hmm.
L-Dopa.
Mm-hmm.
Weird drug name, but L-Dopa. That they were working with and that they thought was going to really help these people who were still in this stasis. And very sadly, and this is, again, this is what's in the movie, and it is true, this is what happened with Sachs's research, they would administer this drug, and people would make a recovery, and they would be doing great, and then they would go back.
Go back, yeah, I remember that. Yeah. And yeah. They just never...
Right, so they
why.
Couldn't, so they, yeah, so that's, so yeah, then they never could really get it forward.
How awful.
There was a lot of, there's been research done in this over the years. There was a more definitive book done in, you know, a lot of research compiled in 2010 by the IU School of Medicine, edited by a guy named Joel Valinsky. And he, you know, pulled a lot of articles and a lot of research and, you know, did things and really dug into it. And this was Valinsky's conclusion that I think really speaks to kind of how weird this whole thing is. Again, this is from a 2010 book. And Valinsky writes, "Does the present volume solve the riddle of EL, which has been referred to as the greatest medical mystery of the 20th century? Unfortunately, no. But inroads are certainly made here pertaining to diagnosis, pathology, and even treatment." So again, have we solved the riddle? It's 100 years later.
Yeah.
Have we solved the riddle?
No.
So still to this day, no knowledge of what it was, why it stopped. And I think the thing that's really, to me, the thing that's really creepy about it, especially in our pandemic world that we live in, is, again, it's that idea that people looked, that there was that epidemic, but people looked back and they found cases
right.
in 1580, in the 1670s, in the 1712, in 1890, in 1917. We still don't know why. We still don't know why it stopped. There, I think it would be foolish to think that there's no reason that it could pop up at some point again.
Do they have theories?
I mean, yeah, there's definitely, you know, theories, but nothing that is deemed to be sort of sound enough.
The first thing that I thought of when you started talking about it was it had something to do with, like, the chemical warfare.
And that was a thought, but that's mostly been ruled out.
Because that was very, very new.
Yeah, but that's mostly been ruled out.
That's been ruled out, okay.
Again, much like the Spanish flu was a theory, but that's kind of been ruled out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it was a time of, like, great collective trauma.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, is there something?
Maybe, but it doesn't really explain the U.S. I don't know. It's hard.
And yeah.
This whole, last thing is this whole illness actually just recently got a little bit of attention shined on it because Neil Gaiman uses it as a plot or a point in his Sandman comics, which were just recently adapted into a TV show for Netflix, maybe? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Somewhere. Somebody just did Sandman. But it references this sleeping sickness. So there's a point in Sandman where it talks about, half of Europe is asleep, yeah. And that is direct reference to the sleeping sickness, which I realized it wasn't my intention here, but I realized that 2 weeks ago, my episode was about the Witchfinder General, which I also thought about based on reading a Neil Gaiman story. So yeah. I apologize for the heavy Neil Gaiman references going on here.
You read
that was not the plan. That was not the intention. So yeah, not a super satisfying ending to this story because I can't really tell you.
I'm very disturbed.
But that's what a real creepy story does, right? Just leaves you with not knowing what the deal is.
Yeah.
So there it is, right. The sleeping sickness.
Oof. Yeah, I definitely have heard of this. I did not realize it. I didn't realize that it was not solved in any way.
At all.
Or that it lasted that long, yep. Like all this stuff. Yeah.
Oh, all right. Wow. All there right. You go.
Great job.
Cheers to Robin Williams and Oliver Sacks. Yay.
Ready for next story?
Oh, I'm ready. How is your hot buttered rum?
It's not bad. I'm just kind of sipping it. It's
all
not
right.
Bad.
All right.
Yeah, I like it. How's yours?
You
like
it? I've drunk a pretty good amount of it. I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah.
I think it's good. I don't know that I'm going to make this a routine beverage that I consume.
I have to say, normally if I have alcohol that is warm, it is too much for me, but this one is there's a smoothness to it.
I can definitely see being I'm serving it at a winter party.
Sure. Yeah.
There you go. All right. What do you got?
All right. So I'm taking you back to 1974. It's early November, November 7th. So,
oh, look at that. Yeah timely. Nice. Right. I like it. 74, just barely. We defined in the first season creepy history as kind of before we were born. So you're just sneaking this one in. I like it.
I don't think we're not sneaking it that close. You don't need to date us.
We're sneaking it close when I'm talking about the 1500s, in the grand scheme of things.
Fair, fair, fair.
Yeah.
Okay. This is the mystery of what happened to Lord Lucan.
Awesome. What happened to Lord Lucan?
Do you know the story?
No, but I love the name.
Very famous. Okay. Here we go.
You always mock me for not knowing
it
your stories.
It is very famous. Okay.
How can you not know Lord Lucan?
November 7th, 1974. Sandra Rivett, she is a nanny. She's about 29 years old. She's working for Lord and Lady Lucan, and they have 3 children. So she is working in their house. It's they live in London. They're in a very wealthy area. Obviously, they have a nanny. They're on 46 Lower Belgrave Street. It's a 6-story brick house. Obviously, Lord and Lady, fancy place. So Sandra Rivett normally had Thursday nights off. This is a Thursday evening. Okay. And that Thursday, she stays late. She's helping the Countess Veronica Lucan, Lady
Ooh,
Lucan,
sure.
Who is the wife of the 7th Earl of Lucan, just to give you some fancy titles. So she stays late that evening to kind of, help Lady Lucan. And Lady Lucan asks her to go and make them tea after the kids are in bed. So she goes downstairs to the basement kitchen, which I know.
Yep, that's bad.
Number one, there should never be a basement kitchen.
No, it's bad.
And if there is, don't go down
there. That's for sure where murders happen.
At night, yeah, for sure. So she goes down to the basement kitchen to make some tea. Lady Lucan, after a while, realizes that she hasn't returned. And just, gets concerned and probably wants her tea. So she's...
She's not back, and I need tea.
And I need that tea.
I've got problems.
So she goes downstairs to see what happened. So Lady Lucan is, very small, kind of slender woman. She reaches the bottom of the stairs, and suddenly she's being attacked. So It's very dark down there, and she's being hit with a lead pipe. And she's screaming, she's fighting back, And she eventually is able to escape.
Okay.
She gets out the basement door, and she runs across the street to a pub called the Plumber's Arms. And then she runs in the door. She bursts in. There's all these, people in there, and she's covered with blood. She's bleeding. She's screaming, and she yells out, "Help me, help me, help me. I've just escaped from being murdered."
Oh, nice.
So, of course, everyone's, up. There's chaos,
sure.
Whatever. The police are called, and they come over to the house. They take Lady Lucan over, and then they discover Sandra Ribbett's body in the basement. She has been beaten to death with a lead pipe.
Oh, goodness. Can we pause for a minute to say, the Plumber's Arms is a really good pub name.
Yeah.
And, if you were writing a movie and you put the Plumber's Arms as a pub name, I'd feel good about that.
Yeah.
Or a book.
It's good. I think it's the Plumber's still Arms. Around.
That's nice.
We'll have to look it up. Anyway, so after this, Lady Lucan then tells the authorities that she recognized the man who attacked her and murdered the nanny.
Was it Lord Lucan?
Now we're going to back up.
Oh, come on.
We're going to back up. All right, you ready?
Now I want to know if it's Lord Lucan.
You need to wait. Okay. So, I'm taking you back. Richard John Bingham, the 7th Earl of Lucan, was born in 1934. That's Lord Lucan.
That's the same guy, yeah.
Correct. Okay. They have a lot of names.
Yeah.
But he was called Lord Lucan.
Bingham. I'm going to call him Bingham.
Yeah,
that's what his buddies call him.
He's obviously born into a lot of wealth. He goes into the army, then he moves into merchant banking, as you do. In 1960, he finds his true profession, which is gambling.
Oh, sure. Bingy always did like a good gamble.
Yeah, he wins £26,000, which is over $500,000.
Oh, geez. Okay.
In about 2 days.
Wow.
Of just straight up gambling, right? So he's just, nonstop, just gaming, drinking rum. And it's just like this crazy lucky streak, and it earns him the nickname Lucky Lucan. Yeah. So that's what he calls. Okay. So after this, he's like, what we've talked about with gamblers before, where they're like, I'm special.
Yeah,
I'm lucky.
Yep, yep.
I'm
Lucky Lucan.
Right. I'm touched by whatever. So he's like, gambling is my profession.
Yeah.
Done and done.
Yep.
He then meets Veronica Duncan at a London event in 1963. They get married later that year. She's sort of like this very, petite, blonde, socialite-y, woman. Whatever.
And that is indeed Lady Lucan.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So he quits his banking job and decides to go into gambling full-time.
Sure. He's Lucky Lucan.
How could it go wrong, is how you ask. It doesn't last. The luck does not last very long.
What a bummer.
Unfortunately. I know you're going to be shocked. He develops a very serious gambling problem.
Oh, man.
He loses a ton of the family money,
uh-huh.
And he gets himself into a ton of debt pretty quickly. Now, you have to remember, these are, these are aristocrats, so they have a way of living that really has to be upheld, right?
Mm.
They own these properties, they own these houses that are, generational, but they have to keep them up.
Yeah.
So it's a real issue where you're like, it's like people who are going to be living lavishly no matter what, but if you actually start to go into, so people will lend them money because they're like, it's the name, and they're like,
yeah,
they're good for it, blah, blah, blah. But then they just get these insane debts because they're just running through money like,
yeah, Tolstoy, crazy. Tolstoy deals with that a lot in some of his stuff. That's a big common theme there.
It's a huge problem.
Yeah.
So Lady Lucan, they're having a lot of marital problems because of the debt. Also, Lady Lucan, she starts struggling with some pretty serious depression, probably postpartum. She, after the birth of, they have three children, and after each birth, she kind of gets worse.
Okay.
And of course, that was, not treated very well at the time.
Yeah, they didn't know it. Yeah.
Not very understood very well at the time. She is treated with antidepressants, which God knows what they were giving her back in the 70s, lithium and things like that. And it sort of worsens over the years. At one point, Lord Lucan checks her into a mental institution, which she escapes.
Oh,
you're like,
geez.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
I'm sure it was not pleasant. And I just love the idea of her just slipping through the door,
yeah,
and taking off. So at first, Lord Lucan is really supportive of this. He really tries to help her, and be there for her. But after a while, he grows tired of it, which is his privilege.
Sure, yeah.
And
I'd rather not deal with this anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Gets sick of it. He's like, I'm really busy gambling and losing all this money. And so he begins to get violent with her, basically.
Okay.
He gets angry, and the marriage really falls apart. So, you know, he's drinking a lot. Shocking.
Yep, yep.
And I think he's actually, like, being physically abusive to her as well. So the marriage falls apart, and it's 1973. He moves out of the family home. He goes into, like, a nearby apartment and starts living there. The divorce is not going well. It's very volatile. Like, there's a lot of fighting. Lord Lucan is very angry with his wife. He's like, you know, she's the one living in his family's home, and he feels like if he could just sell the house, he could pay off all the debts. He's very upset that he's not given custody of his three children. He feels like, you know, I mean, this is back in a time where I'm sure mothers almost always got the full custody.
Uh-huh.
But he feels like she isn't stable enough to, you know, to be...
Right, sure.
Like, get him in the custody. He at one point accuses her of killing a kitten that he bought for the children.
Wow.
Yeah, it gets really nasty. Apparently the kitten is found shoved into his mailbox with the throat cut.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Now it's back and forth where they're like, did she do it? Did he do it so he could accuse her? Like, you know what I mean? It's not great. He tries to convince a judge that she's not mentally stable enough to care for the children. The judge disagrees, but he does tell Lady Lucan that she can keep custody, but she must have a nanny, like basically a full-time nanny helping her.
Okay.
So I think the judge is sort of understanding that Lady Lucan is not doing great.
Yeah.
But there's just a real resistance, I think, to take children away from
you know,
the mother and to give them to a father. Yeah, that kind of thing. Okay, so that's the background.
Okay.
And now we're back to our November night in, what did I say, 1974?
74,
yeah, November 7th. Okay, so the police arrive at the Lucan home. They find a pipe. They find Sandra Rivett's body in the basement.
Okay.
Lady Lucan tells the people at the bar, and she tells the police that it is her husband.
Aha,
that
I knew
she
it.
She saw in the basement.
Yes.
She's like, I saw him clear as day. I know it was him. She said she came face to face with him, and he began attacking her. At one point, he stuck his fingers down her throat to stop her from screaming.
Okay.
She's pretty wounded at this point. I mean, he's really hitting her, and she begs, please don't kill me, John. So, I mean, she names him, and then she said at that point, he kind of pulls back. And that she was able to,
and like, that's how she was able to escape. Yeah.
Yeah, and she was able to escape.
Right.
It is believed pretty much right off the bat that the murder of Sandra Rivett, of the nanny, was believed to be a mistake. Like,
oh, like she came down and he thought it was
correct.
Her.
Correct. Okay, got so it. So they were similar height. They think they had similar coloring, you know, things like that. It was very dark. And also the nanny was not supposed to be there that night.
Sure.
She normally had that evening off. So he assumed, they're thinking like he assumed his wife came and was coming downstairs and he just sees a woman, like, you know, a figure coming downstairs and just immediately starts beating her. And then realizes later, maybe when, you know, Lady Lucan comes down herself that he,
yes, got it.
You know, it's the wrong person.
That makes sense.
And they said the basement lights weren't, the downstairs lights weren't working. I don't know if he did something to them or if they just weren't. Sandra Rivett was about the same height and build of Lady Lucan, and in the darkness it would have been very hard to tell them apart. Lord Lucan is actually seen running away from the house.
All right, that doesn't do well. That's not going to help the case.
By, like, you know, because she comes running into the pub. She's bleeding. She's screaming.
Yeah.
Everyone starts spilling out on the street.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think, like, people see him.
Who's that?
Running away.
Oh, that's crazy old Lord Lucan running off.
After leaving the house, Lucan, he goes to a family, to a friend's house, and he tells this crazy story about how he was walking by his old house. He sees his wife through the window. She's struggling with somebody, like with some strange man. He goes inside. He slips on some blood. What was that?
That was me. That was, I moved my feet.
Oh,
I apologize.
Very scary.
I just moved my foot. I dared to move my foot. You freaked yourself out by Lord Lucan's story.
Really, really upsetting. Anyway.
It literally was me moving my foot.
He goes inside to help his wife who's being attacked by this strange man.
Uh-huh.
You know, he slips in a pool of blood and scares off the intruder.
Nah,
that's his story.
Success. That's amazing.
And then he claims that Lady Lucan is completely hysterical and runs out screaming and says that, you know, he hired someone to kill her.
I love this idea that he then, like, goes to a friend's house. He's like, hey,
he's like,
you're never going to believe what happened to me.
You know what happened to me tonight?
Listen to this story. Give me a whiskey. I got a story.
You want to know I got blood all over me? It's crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. You got any cards? Let's play some games. Come on.
So then when she runs out of the house, And she's so hysterical because she's, you know, like got mental lady problems.
Yep.
And she's screaming. He decides it's going to look really bad for him and he better just take off.
Yeah, sure.
As he does.
Again, telling his friend, be like, ah, I should probably go.
Yeah. So that's his story. The story is very suspicious.
It is indeed. Indeed it is.
The police go immediately to Lord Lucan's apartment after this because they're searching for him. They find his wallet, his passport, and his car keys. Later on, a few days later, they find his car abandoned by the coast. Like several days later, you know, they're looking for him.
It's very hard for me to, I appreciate you saying the car because it keeps reminding me it's 1974.
I know.
It's very hard for me to not envision this as like 1600. Yeah. You know what I mean? Everything I'm envisioning in my head is not the right period.
Yeah. Inside the car, they find bloodstains. They find a pipe.
Okay. Well, that's not going well.
And, you know, the evidence is stacking up against him. George Weiss, who's one of Lucky Lucan's gambling friends, he tells the police that the Lord Lucan discussed how he was plotting his wife's murder over a game of backgammon the day before. So they're playing backgammon. Am I saying that right? Backgammon?
Backgammon.
Yeah. They're playing backgammon, and he's like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to kill my wife.
This isn't looking good. This is not going well.
No, and Weiss says, he's quoted as saying, he went to his house that day with his mind set on killing his wife. He saw no way back into the family life and the life of his children. I like how Weiss is like, nothing I could do about it.
Yeah.
I can't tell anybody.
Yeah.
I can't give, you know, Lady Lucan a heads up or maybe call the police.
That's weird.
What are you going to do?
Just a good note. If someone tells you that they're planning to murder someone, like, you should probably do something about it.
Just probably assume that.
Like, just do take some action.
He's like, can I borrow a pipe?
Yeah.
Do you have a pipe I can borrow?
Just do something.
Yeah. So now we come to the disappearance.
Ooh, okay.
That's right. So no one knows what happened to Lord Lucan after he flees the scene that night.
Well, he goes to his friend's house and then he flees from his friend's house.
We know that he goes to his friend's house, Susan Maxwell Scott, in a borrowed car.
That's the person that he gave the whole spiel to.
Correct.
Okay.
So he goes to Susan Maxwell Scott's house. He tells Maxwell Scott his side of the story. And then he leaves her home at about 1:15 in the morning. And she is the last person to see him.
Wow.
As far as we know. Later that night, I think in her house, he writes. So he goes to her house. He tells her the story. And he's having drinks, whatever. He writes a bunch of letters. In her house. He writes one to the owner of the car that he was borrowing.
Okay.
He writes a letter to his brother-in-law. In both the letters, he says he's innocent. And to the one to his brother-in-law, he talks a bunch about his wife's mental condition.
His brother-in-law being the wife's brother or his sister's husband?
I am not 100% sure.
It's a big difference.
I know. It doesn't say.
I wonder.
I'm assuming that it's his wife's brother.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
That'd be an interesting person to write to. Anyway, interesting. Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
You're right. Maybe it is his sister's husband.
Right.
Okay.
Who knows?
I'll see if I can.
Intriguing, though. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not sure.
See if I can make the foot sound again and freak you out.
So he takes these letters, gives them to Susan, you know, Max Scott to send, and then he just kind of vanishes. There is no clue where no one knows what happened to him after that. Some people believe that his body, that he never left Susan Maxwell Scott's estate, that, like, either he committed suicide or someone, you know, killed him and he was buried there. Many other people believe he, you know, died soon after that. And many people believe that he didn't die, you know, like, soon after that at all. Like, he kind of escaped and, like, went on the run.
Sure.
So a lot of people feel like his gambling buddies, he had enough of a network in terms of like being an aristocrat and, you know, in his sort of like underground gambling world that they, hid him away somewhere. They helped him get out of the country.
Yeah. They could like travel the world and gamble and hide and stuff like
exactly.
that. Right. Yeah.
There have been sightings. So this was huge news, right? Like it's all over the papers, big, big news. And of course everyone's looking for him. So there's sightings everywhere. There's sightings in 70 countries around the
world. Oh, wow. Jeez.
Including the Netherlands, South Africa, Ireland, Peru, the U.S., whatever you can think of. So every, like, that's how big of a news story it was. And then, of course, everybody thinks they see him. There's a report in the paper that he's living as a hippie musician in in the jungle. A report from New Zealand where there's a man who is accused of being Lord Lucan is living out of a Land Rover with a goat named Camilla in 2007.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And neither person turns out to be him. There's just tons of stories. And then another, like, really weird one says that there was a man who ran the gambling club that Lord Lucan went to often, who was, like, a zookeeper named John Aspinall. And there was a big theory that Lord Lucan, like, is going to his gambling buddies for help. Mm-hmm. They sort of feel like he's too, like, dangerous to keep around. And they basically kill him, and then they feed him to Aspinall, like, to these tigers.
What?
To get rid of the body.
Come on.
That's some big theory that went around in the papers for a really long
time. That seems like a lot.
Yeah.
We're getting into real Tiger King country area here.
but the interesting thing is, so there's just a lot of people who felt like he got away and he was just sort of living on the lam for the rest of his life mm-hmm. and like died of old age or something like that in a different country. But of course, it was just, there was never any proof of it. There was never any like really substantiated sightings. A lot of people also felt like that he never really left England, that, you know, pretty soon after, like, his, you know, aristocratic or the family or, you know, things like that, they sort of were like, he just has to be gotten rid of. He's done too much. He's in too much debt. He's brought too much heat on everybody else. And so he was basically just sort of killed and buried somewhere. And then that was the end of it.
Okay. Got it.
So the children are still, like they grew up.
I forgot they were children.
The 70s.
Yeah.
So, you know, so George Bingham is the 8th Earl of Lucan.
Uh-huh.
And his father was declared legally dead in 2016.
Okay.
So
yeah,
I know it
takes
a long time.
Yeah.
George Bingham, the new Lord of Lucan, he states in interviews that he always believed that his father was dead. He was 7 years old when his father disappeared, and he's quoted as saying, "In circumstances, I would think it possible that he saw his life at an end, regardless of guilt or otherwise, being dragged through the courts, and the media would have destroyed his personal life, his career, and the chances of getting custody of his children back. And that may well have pushed a man to end his own life, but I have no idea." So he is of the mind, which a lot of people were as well, that Lord Lucan like just kind of committed suicide.
Yeah, yeah.
So then like he also never left Susan Maxwell Scott's house. He kind of, you know, went somewhere, committed suicide, and then was like buried or whatever. Like they got rid of
him. They like hit him or something like that. Yeah.
But again, you know, it was thought maybe he was smuggled to Africa. There was reports that the children knew about it and they were flown there, you know, to see him occasionally. But Bingham seems to, you know, that kind of contradicted that.
Sure.
You know,
right.
Really felt like he died. So Sandra Rivett, the nanny, unfortunately, also had a child.
And she died, right?
She was dead. Lady Lucan survived.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sandra Rivett was killed, yes, and murdered. And so she had a son as well, which is terribly sad. So in 1982, 8 years after Sandra Rivett's death and their father's disappearance, the Lucan children were removed from their mother's custody.
Oh.
She was, you know, she was just not mentally
sure.
I think this, you know. So they were placed in their aunt's, the mother's sister's care. And eventually Lady Lucan cut off all communication with her children and her sister in the 1980s. And she died in 2017.
Okay.
She cut all three children out of her will, citing the lack of good manners and shown to me as their parent.
No.
I know. It's really bad. It's
really
bad. So Lord Lucan's three children also had many legal issues to deal with surrounding their father's disappearance. There was no body. They didn't have a death certificate. His gambling debts were enormous, and sorting out his estate was really terrible. He was, eventually declared dead much later. And then that was the other thing. Like, George, the son couldn't take the title over.
Right, as you say, you can't be the Lord until he's officially dead, right?
Couldn't take over the estates.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of like a home. So he was basically forced to take what's called a courtesy title of Lord Bingham until his father was proven dead. In 2014, he applied for an official death certificate. And then that was granted in 2016.
Got it.
There was a trial, though.
Oh.
So the trial involving the murder of Sandra Rivett was June 5th, 1975, and they testified with Lady Lucan and many of the people who, you know, witnessed things at night and saw Lord Lucan running away and, you know, people that talked to him afterwards. So it was illegal to force her to give evidence against her husband because they were still married, but she did so no problem.
One would imagine she's ready to go. She's
like,
yeah,
I'm here. Blood samples and fibers were put forward as evidence, which, you know, it was very early for that, but they've done. But basically, it was overwhelming evidence that he did it, and
yeah,
it took the jury a half an hour to declare Lord Lucan guilty.
Sure,
even though he was absent.
In absentia.
In absentia. Yeah. There you go.
There's your legal terms.
After the death of his mother, Sandra Rivett's son, Neil Berryman, he was not convinced that Lord Lucan was dead.
Okay.
And, you know, he's obviously grown now. He felt that Lord Lucan was guilty and had probably killed himself after that. He thought that the idea that, like, Lord Lucan killed himself was, like, just too convenient.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And too easy. And he is quoted as saying, "Maybe the police know more than they let on, but at the end, we have to get to the truth and justice for Sandra. A horrible death, a young woman beaten, my mother. There is no getting away from the fact that whatever happened that night, Lord Lucan is guilty of something in my eyes."
Wow.
And that is the story of Lord Lucan.
Wow. Interesting.
And nobody knows.
Real ambiguous night here in Creepy History Land. Yeah.
I mean, we got nothing.
We're not giving you guys a whole lot of endings.
No answers from us tonight.
Nothing.
Yeah.
It's a whole, like, existential, like, are there really answers to anything out there?
And it's just such a sad story in some ways because it's so salacious of these two like rich people, you know, with, like, you know, probably drinking and gambling and debt problems and just, you know, whatever. And they're fighting and they're doing all these awful things. And then this poor working class woman is the one that, like, loses her life.
Is, like, shoved over in the middle of it.
Yeah. And then this son grows up without his mother. And it's just, it's really terrible.
Yeah.
But then you also have these three children who end up with, like, no parents because of this, you know, just.
For
anyway.
Sure.
Huh. It's very sad.
No, that's really interesting. Yeah,
no idea what happened to him.
That's fascinating.
He's just gone.
Is there where did you land in the research of it? Did you have a particular one that you bought into?
He does not seem the type of person to me to commit suicide.
Uh-huh.
I have to say, I kind of really have a feeling that, like, he was kind of just done away with.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think he had some really shady
underground
stuff going on. I think he owed people a lot of money. I think, you know, that world is a lot seedier than people think it is.
Yeah.
I think he brought a lot of, like, terrible press. And, you know, I just think that, like, it was that kind of, like, we're going to handle our own sort of justice.
Gatsby stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they were like, he's just going to disappear. Because I feel like he does not seem savvy enough to me to have gone his entire and not have been found.
Right.
Like, he would have kept relying on his friends. He would have kept popping up.
We've talked about this in earlier episodes. It's very hard.
He was a drunk and he was a gambler.
Right.
Like, he was going to keep running out of money. He was going to keep drinking. He was not the kind of person who could just go on the run and, like, really stay under radar for the rest of his life.
Yeah, it's very hard.
Like, for decades.
Huh.
And I think people knew that, and people didn't want to be associated with him. And he was just going to keep leeching off of everyone. So I think they just took him out to, like, a moor, and that was it.
Yep. Good stuff.
Yep.
Wow. Really interesting.
So, all right. Well, I hope that keeps you guys up a little bit longer tonight.
Oh, yeah, wondering. Lots of questions.
If you have trouble sleeping, drink some hot buttered rum.
The hot buttered rum is going to put you to sleep.
It probably will.
You didn't drink a whole lot of it.
No. I had some, though.
It's good.
I had, like, half the mug.
It's
pretty good.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy your hot buttered rum.
Yeah. See you next week.
We'll see you next week.